Winter doesn't stop boats from sailing. For more than a century, Wisconsinites have sailed across the ice. Wendy Lutzke took up ice boating a few years ago and explains what makes the sport so addicting.
DN, Renegade, Knight, Skeeter, Stern Steerer, Runner Plank, Tiller, Light Air, Heavy Air. These words were not part of my regular vocabulary. Then I went ice boating. Ice boating requires many levels of patience. Just as surfers seek out the best waves and skiers love perfect powder, ice boaters crave decent wind and smooth, black, thick ice clear of snow. That's not always easy to find, especially during snowy winters. So ice boaters always have to be ready to go at a moment's notice to a sweet ice spot, a location that might be hours away. Once you're there, you have to put your boat together. Nuts, bolts, sheets, stays, blades, and sails get twisted, unfurled, and tightened with cold fingers while you're kneeling or lying on the ice. All of this is done as efficiently as possible, so the majority of your time can be spent sailing. The wind could die or become dangerously gusty, so every moment counts. When my friend Jeff invited me to go ice boating with him recently, I didn't hesitate. We discovered that a spot was clear on Lake Winnebago and hit the road. Jeff owns the DN class of ice boat. It's a light, slender boat atop a runner plank with blades that look like they're from the ice skates of a giant. You lie on your back, feet first in the hollow cockpit, with your head slightly raised. You have one hand on a tiller to control the movement of your bow, and the other on the main sheet to capture the wind in your sail. Once you've positioned your sail to capture the wind, you have to be ready to move because you can literally move as fast as the wind across the flat sheet of lake ice. You're constantly alternating your focus between the condition of the ice ahead of you and the reaction of the sail to the wind. Hitting a hole in the ice can lead to a crash, while letting the wind carry you out of control can lift you up and over. Not fun either way. On my second ice boating escapade with Jeff, this time on Green Lake, the folks there welcomed us into their ice boating family without hesitation. That's just how ice boaters are. Talk centered on equipment, wind speed, and ice condition. Advice runs freely among ice boaters since safety is a prime concern in this extreme sport. Jeff's willingness to share his valuable boat with this novice is a true example of ice boating friendship. For me, the lure of ice boating lies in the intensity of being extremely alert and alive. I love the challenge of paying attention with my eyes and responding with my hands. The clean scrape of the blades on ice and the whistling of the wind as the boat picks up speed are invigorating. And it reminds me why I live in Wisconsin, for the adventure of four distinct seasons and new ways to get out and enjoy them, with people crazy enough to skitter across the ice on a boat.
Wendy Lutzke is the Director of Education at the Wisconsin Maritime Museum. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
Well, who doesn't love a good nautical mystery? 335 years ago, a French ship known as Le Griffon, or the Griffin, set sail from Washington Island as part of its maiden voyage, only to disappear forever, at least until now. Maybe. Historians think the Griffin was the first European ship to sail the Upper Great Lakes and the first one to sink there, but there's not a lot of evidence to go by.
Our next guest says after years of searching, he's finally found the ship's remains on the bottom of Lake Michigan, and he says there's a lot we can learn from it.
Here's a conversation we had with Steve Liebert. He's the president of the Great Lakes Exploration Group. Steve, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, Steve, you've been a little obsessed with the Griffin since you were a kid. How did you first get so fascinated with it?
You know, and that's a great word, Veronica, obsession and passion. But believe it or not, I was 14 years old, and I'm 60 years old now. But when I was 14, I was in eighth grade, and one of my history teachers, he was talking about early European exploration into the present interior of the United States. And he was talking about La Salle. He talked about his ship Griffin and the figurehead, which was part lion and part eagle. And I was just mesmerized by the story, and actually just basically sitting in class dreaming, you know, about that ship. And he'd walk right behind me and put his right hand on my left shoulder and said, "Who knows, maybe someone in this room will find it one day."
Wow.
And so it was a teacher that had a lot of influence and a lot of impact on my life as far as looking for the Griffin.
Well, something about that story fascinated you to this day, and maybe some of it has to do with the history of the ship itself. Can you talk us through a little bit about what the Griffin was and what its journey was like before it sank?
Yes. LaSalle obtained permission from King Louis XIV to build a ship above the Niagara Falls, in which he did, and he obviously named it the Griffin. And it set sail in 1679, and I take that back, 1678. It was actually under construction, but so it set sail. It took less than a year to build the vessel. And as far as we know it, and from the research primary source documents, the Griffin made it to present-day Washington Island. And then LaSalle decided that he needed to resupply, so he sent the Griffin back to present Kingston, Canada. And at the time, it was Fort Frontenac. So the Griffin left Washington Island. LaSalle took canoes and the rest of his men, and he went to the southern lake, part of Lake Michigan, to wait for the Griffin's return, but it never returned. Some years later, LaSalle came back and finally transitioned down through the Mississippi River to present-day New Orleans, which he obviously claimed the territory for King Louis XIV, and then a lot of the lands west of the Mississippi River, known as the Louisiana Territory. Now, a lot of that land we know today as the Louisiana Purchase when in 1803 President Jefferson sent James Monroe over to actually purchase New Orleans, but Bonaparte decided, hey, I have this other land and you can have it for $15 million. And they were ready to spend $10 million for New Orleans, but so Monroe thought to himself, well, you know, if it's that other land, let's take it for $15 million. Why not? And now what's the importance of it? Well, it actually expanded the United States twofold at that time in 1803, and the United States built forts, and they expanded further to the West Coast, Pacific Ocean, which is a natural line of defense. So
so a long history there.
A long history,
leading
yeah.
from and the Griffin. Why do you think you found it?
Well, you know, we've been searching for this vessel for many years. A lot of people were looking in Lake Huron, and I can understand why. But, you know, I sort of went a step further as far as the research and discovered primary source documents in the French archives. And, of course, we had those documents translated two or three times by experts in French. Each translation always said something a little different. And that got me to believing that this ship didn't go down Lake Huron. It went down Lake Michigan. And in that primary source documents, in some of those pages, they actually describe the islands in the land. And I said, that can only be one place, and that's the Garden Islands that, you know, tip up Green Bay, and which actually is Wisconsin, and then it goes into Michigan. And we went looking, and then in 2001, I bumped into what I thought was a bowsprit. Now, in 2001, you have to remember, a lot of the zebra mussels just started, as far as the northern Lake Michigan started coming into those waters, and visibility was only about 3 to 6 inches where we were diving. Today, it's probably 25, 30 feet because of the zebra mussels have cleaned up the water that good. And now the zebra mussels are dying off because there's nothing else to eat.
Right, so you found that one plankboard back several years ago. Now you've got a whole area that seems to be some detritus and wreckage there. What makes you think that this is the Griffin?
Well, I won't go through the whole process because, you know, we finally took years to get the French archaeologists over to actually dive on this piece of timber we thought was a bowsprit. And then we also had to go through the legal process to obtain permits and so we can excavate. Well, last June we excavated the bowsprit. It was extracted. The scientists, we studied it quite a bit, and we found out from erosion marks that piece is at least 200 to 300 years old. And, you know, if it's 300 years old, there's only one documented ship that we know of that ever went down in the Upper Great Lakes, mm-hmm. and that's the Griffin. So now what happened last year, our permits ran out. We only had 6 days on location. This year we went back out and started doing more remote sensing work using the sector scan sonar. And we found more wreckage. And then we sent divers down. Water was extremely cold. But Tommy Gwine of Great Lakes Diving and Salvage and Joe Schaefer did an excellent job. They're in hot water suits, walking along the bottom, and they're looking at this wreckage and then taking photographs and pictures of the fittings that are part of the wreckage. The only problem, Veronica, we weren't finding any cultural materials like, you know, pottery, tools, eating utensils, that sort of thing. And then I went back to look at some surveys that I had performed probably almost 15 years ago, and I couldn't believe it. I said we were right on top of it the whole time, because it did show off magnetic anomalies. So what we believe that to be is the hull of the ship buried, and that's where we're going to find the cannons and the cannonballs and,
wow.
and cultural material.
So that's remarkable. So what would you like to see done with this ship if it is indeed the Griffin, and what would it mean to you if it is? And I'm sorry, we've only got about 30 seconds left.
Well, real fast, the ship belongs to France, so that's their call. But I would like to see it extracted, reassembled, and put into a museum somewhere. That would be France's call. And it could be Wisconsin, it could be Illinois, it could be Michigan. I know there's a couple groups that want to build a replica of the Griffin for the tall ships display. And but I would just like to see it displayed so people can actually see it and let people know of all the techniques that we use.
That was Steve Liebert. He's the president of the Great Lakes Exploration Group.